Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, Chicago and violent crime has become a national topic. President Trump is using that as a key reason to bring federal agents to the city. But the numbers tell a different story. We'll have more. BB guns are looking more like the real thing. That can have dangerous consequences, we have a report. Also, we'll hear from a Republican candidate for governor, Ted Dabrowski. We'll learn how drought is causing more problems for plants when it comes to pests and disease. The bur oak tree, known as the king of the Great Plains, has become susceptible. There are specialty bookstores dedicated to cookbooks. We'll visit one of those. And roller derby, still going strong. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Chicago has been in the spotlight as the president talks about, quote, cleaning up the city's violent crime. But an analysis finds violent crime is down in Chicago. From June through August, the city had the fewest murders in 60 years. Chip Mitchell did the reporting. He spoke with Lisa Labas.
All right, so first we heard that crime was down in Chicago, but you've added some historical context. Let's get into it.
Yeah, we looked at two things. First, the city's murder counts. Chicago murders this past June, July, and August totaled 123. We also used the state open records law to get historical data for some of the context. We found that this year's summer murder total, 123, was the lowest for those 3 months since 1965, Lisa. Now, second, we looked at violent crime overall, not just those murders, but also robberies, aggravated batteries, sexual assaults, and so on. We went through CPD annual reports one by one and found that last year's violent crime total was down more than two-thirds since a 1991 peak. And that drop has continued, Lisa. Violent crime so far this year is down 21% from last year to this date.
So what are some of the reasons experts are pointing to account for this drop?
Well, experts are pointing to stuff like policing focused on hot spots and investment in community violence intervention. That's where ex-offenders who have deep roots in a neighborhood, they mediate disputes, ward off retaliatory attacks, and connect potential shooters to social services.
All right, so now you've got the numbers that you've researched, but there's public perception, and that's a very different thing. And Chicago did have a lot of violence over this past Labor Day weekend. What do you say about that?
Yeah, shootings and other attacks over the three-day weekend killed at least 9 people. Chicago still has a big problem with guns, for sure. And we have to recognize that a lot of people are suffering because of it. But we also have to look at more than a single weekend. We have to look at months and quarters and years and even decades to see how far Chicago has come in reducing its violent crime, what it took to get this far, what it took, and what it will take to reduce it a lot further.
So I know when you did your reporting, you spoke with people who are doing a lot of different sorts of work on Chicago public safety at the neighborhood level. In light of your findings, what do they think about the federal operations that the president is planning? How did people respond?
Well, it's a big mix, Lisa. A lot of people say Trump's plan is coming out of left field in light of these low crime numbers, and he's just trying to show what a strong man he is. The head of street outreach for a nonprofit on the Southwest Side, he said immigration agents and National Guard troops could complicate his group's community violence intervention. He's worried some high-risk people won't want to work with the group because they're undocumented. And he pointed out that businesses are already suffering because many immigrants are afraid to leave their homes. And I spoke with an elected police district council member who lives and works in a West Side area that's had a lot of shootings in recent weeks. He says most of his neighbors would support a National Guard deployment if it were focused on guns and drugs. He's especially concerned about switches, those devices that turn pistols into machine guns.
Sure.
But we'll see how aggressive the feds are with Chicago guns. The Trump administration has rolled back gun control regulations. It's marginalized the agency that enforces gun laws. And Lisa, it's shifted a lot of law enforcement to focus on immigration control.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. WBEZ's Chip Mitchell looking at crime statistics in Chicago. Thanks, Chip.
My pleasure.
Member station WGLT in Bloomington Normal has been reporting on guns, and in this story, they looked at BB guns. Today's are more sophisticated and often resemble real weapons, Ryan Denham reports.
Before his fatal confrontation with police, 15-year-old Cole Turner of Normal had something to show off to his friends, his new gun. It wasn't a real gun, but it sure looked like it. The Sig Sauer P365 BB gun is nearly identical to its bullet-firing twin. Authorities say his friends saw it up close and thought it was real. So did police. 2 days after Turner bought the gun, Bloomington police say he pointed it at officers who had cornered him in an apartment parking lot.
What's going on today, man? Why are you like this?
What you mean? I ain't doing nothing.
Okay, why don't you just drop the gun?
They shot and killed him. Prosecutors who reviewed the case say the officers were legally justified in part because they couldn't tell the gun was fake.
There are no markings on this weapon which identifies the gun as a replica of a real weapon, nor identifies it as a non-lethal handgun.
That's Police Chief Jamal Symington speaking at a press conference after the shooting.
In this incident, 4 of our community members observed this individual with a gun. All 4 feared for their safety, as did the involved officers.
Turner was not the only young person in Bloomington Normal with an imitation gun. Local police say they're encountering them more frequently, often among young people for whom guns are a status symbol. Like all commodities, fakes can be an easy way to get what you want. And unlike real guns, imitations, which can threaten others and get you killed, are barely regulated. And even those regulations have loopholes.
Honestly, this is not an area that I've seen a lot of attention focused on.
Adam Skaggs is chief counsel and vice president at the Giffords Law Center to prevent gun violence.
There is more attention, whether you want to say on the left and the right, but from all sides of the political issue, I think there's much more concern about regulating actual firearms than there is about toy or imitation firearms.
One group that is paying attention is Bloomington and Normal Police. Bloomington Police spokesperson Officer Bryce Jansen says they see fake guns frequently.
There's many cases a year where, you know, a juvenile will have a realistic gun sitting on the back seat or in their backpack, something of that nature.
It happens enough that Normal Police collect and share intelligence about people known to have realistic-looking fake guns. That's according to Normal Police spokesperson Officer Brad Park.
Because the officers need to know, okay, we know that this person was located having an airsoft gun that looked like a realistic firearm, because the goal is we know they're going to use that gun to try to make it as if they had a real firearm.
Authorities say Turner bought his Sig Sauer BB gun 2 days before his fatal shooting February 25th. It's unclear where he bought it. State police investigated his death but has not responded yet to WGLT's request for documents related to the case. Authorities say Turner's BB gun didn't even work, suggesting it was not bought new. But had he wanted to, Turner could have bought a new one on Sig Sauer's website for $130 with free shipping. He would have had to check a single box to certify he was at least 21 years old. Sig Sauer markets the BB gun as a low-cost alternative to its popular bullet-firing sibling, complete with a blowback slide that mimics the real thing. Sig Sauer did not respond to a request for comment for this story. Ostensibly, a BB gun like this is meant for training and target practice. So we wanted to know, if they're used for training and target practice, why the heck do they need to look so realistic?
Because people want them all over the world. They want those things.
That's Richard Pearson, executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association.
We have to look at the other side of it, the people who are doing the right thing. We always take action against people. We want to take action against people who do the wrong thing, but then we punish the people who do the right things.
There are federal regulations that apply to certain lookalikes, like toy guns and water guns, that requires bright markings, often orange, or another obvious indicator that it's fake. That requirement does not apply to traditional BB guns, paintball guns, or pellet-firing air guns. States vary in how they regulate them. Illinois merely prohibits sales to those under age 13. Here's Adam Skaggs again with the Giffords Law Center.
Our position is that if you're selling a product that any observer is going to think is a firearm, but is not, it'd be appropriate to require that those have, you know, bright colors, so that they wouldn't be mistaken for a weapon.
Richard Pearson with the State Rifle Association says that wouldn't work.
Well, we tried that. All they do is paint it black. You go out and buy a can of black spray paint, they spray the thing.
Pearson says it's parents who should control juvenile access to imitation guns like this. Make sure they're trained on what to do or what not to do.
So we've had one incident here among the millions and millions that are out there. So I think one of the things we can't do is we can't make a law because of one or two incidents. You just can't do that.
Except it's not one or two incidents. Nationally, there were 364 people injured or killed in police shootings involving a BB or replica gun between 2015 and 2020. That's according to the Center for Gun Violence Solutions at Johns Hopkins. Here's Adam Skaggs again with Giffords.
One serious concern that these kind of look-alike firearms have is that they can be mistaken for a real gun, and whether by law enforcement or by another individual, if you see someone carrying what you think is a gun, you may perceive a threat.
Ryan Denham with that report. Next year, we'll bring another gubernatorial election to Illinois. Ted Dabrowski is president of the conservative media outlet Wire Points. He's running for the Republican nomination. Brian Sapp of WSIU caught up with him at the recent DuQuoin State Fair.
I live in Wilmette. I got a wife and four children, and they're young adults now. I've been back in Illinois for about almost 18 years. And I've been running a group called Wire Points. Many people may know me through Wire Points, where we do research, commentary, data on Illinois and its problems. And we've been promoting solutions for Illinois for a long time. And I've been doing that so long that I'm finally saying, hey, I can't keep researching and writing and arguing for it. I got to jump in the ring and take action. And so here I am running for governor.
And that was my next question. That's kind of what pushed you into making this decision to run for governor?
Yeah, well, look, you know, my parents were immigrants to, they were legal immigrants to Illinois. My mother from Ecuador, my dad from Poland. You know, they came to Illinois in 1960-ish. And when they came here, this place was booming, right? People were coming from all over the world for their economic freedom, for opportunity. And fast forward to today, people are fleeing the state, and I don't like that. I hate that. We should be a top five state in this country, but instead we're losing people. Our failed government is chasing people away, and I want to change that. We should be a top five state in this country for economic growth and opportunity.
What are some of the things you want to do to tackle that, to make that change?
Well, look, it's too expensive to live here. There aren't enough good jobs. Our children aren't learning how to read, and people are leaving. So you got to unwind all those. We got to make it affordable again for people. It's got, you know, look at the gas taxes, look at the property taxes. We got to bring them down. You know, when you talk about jobs, we're not creating jobs anymore. Under Governor Pritzker, there's almost been zero jobs created since he took office. So we need to obsess about creating jobs and opportunity for people. And one of the big things I want to do is bring back literacy. Our kids can't read anymore, and I want to fight for literacy.
Illinois is a big state, big urban populations, rural populations down here.
Mm-hmm.
What, I've asked this question the other direction, what are the Chicago Democrats going to do to connect with rural southern Illinois? What are you going to do to connect down here and connect with the people that are urban?
What are Chicago Democrats going to do? Because they don't, right? I mean, you've got to disenfranchise southern Illinois and central Illinois. That's why you have 33 counties that have, you know, wanting to secede. They don't. Pritzker and the Democrats have not listened at all to the people down here. And you have to listen. You know, and I've been engaged with all parts of the state since I've been doing this. And you know, you have to listen and understand the problems. And we should be fighting for the success of our cities. I want to see Decatur grow again. I want to see Peoria grow again. I want to see Rockford, you know, revive. We should be able to figure out how to do that. But to do that, we have to attract business, and we have to stop scaring people away.
And you think that's what'll help you connect with those urban populations that might lean a little more progressive?
Oh, you mean with the urban progressive? Look, you know, they have the same problems too. They're paying the highest property taxes in the country. They're paying the second highest gas taxes in the country. You know, companies like big companies like Caterpillar are leaving. Come on, we got to flip it all around. We got the wrong formula right now, and we got to flip it for everybody, for all Illinoisans.
Okay. What do you think the statewide numbers? You know, you're a numbers guy. What do you think you can do to, do you have some headwinds, and how are you going to overcome those?
Well, look, I'm going to speak for everyday Illinoisans. You know, right now, Governor Pritzker, you know, he speaks for the political class. You know, he hasn't created jobs. He keeps raising taxes. His spending keeps going up. And he doesn't seem to care about everyday people. So for me to connect, I want to connect with the everyday Illinoisans. You know, my parents were immigrants. I said we were those people before, right? People struggling, trying to make ends meet. And I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of disenfranchised Chicagoans. You had the illegal immigration, disenfranchised the blacks. They're not happy. Latinos aren't happy with all those illegal immigrants that came in. So there are people looking for change, and I think we saw that with Trump, the support that Trump got. People are looking for something different. That's how he got Latinos to vote for him. That's how he got blacks to vote for him. They're hungry for something different, and we need to offer that. Governor Pritzker doesn't offer that.
One last question on something topical. Governor Pritzker's been in the news. President Trump has talked about, you know, the crime in Chicago. Where's your stance on that?
Oh man, I'll tell you this. President Trump is right to bring up this issue, because crime is a massive problem in Chicago. Chicago has led the country for 13 years in a row with the highest murder total in the country. That's a problem. And just because crime is a little lower right now doesn't mean it's not an emergency, especially if you live on the south side or the west side of Chicago. It's an emergency. You can't have your kids go outside because they may get shot. And it is an emergency. And Pritzker is trying to pretend like it's not it's not a big deal. Look at our city. He points at the nice river. If you saw the video, he's totally missing the boat. Trump is right. We need safe cities. We don't need lower crime. We need a safe city. And it's the same thing for downstate and southern Illinois. We need safe cities. And it's a great thing he's pushing for. It may not be constitutional what he wants to do, and it'll be litigated in the courts, but at least he's right to bring up the issue.
Talking about President Trump, he can be a lightning rod. Do you welcome him, his help or support, in bringing this attention to Illinois?
Well, look, I'm a common sense conservative. And there's a lot of good things that Trump is doing. He's fixing the border, right? He's trying to bring manufacturing back to America. He's concerned about crime. In my administration, I would be working with the administration to do the good things that can happen together. But Pritzker, you can see what he's doing. He's running away from Illinoisans. He's running for president. He's running for the far left side of the presidency. And Pritzker's disconnecting with Illinoisans, and Trump's kind of taking the spot.
Ted Dabrowski is running for the Republican nomination for governor of Illinois. We'll hear from other candidates in the weeks ahead. Also having announced a run for the Republican nomination, the DuPage County Sheriff Jim Mindrick, Lake Forest resident Joe Severino, and news this week that former state senator Darren Bailey, who ran unsuccessfully as his party's nominee in 2022, will make another bid for governor. There's more ahead on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The interest in local food systems like farmers markets and direct farm-to-consumer sales is on the rise, but the U.S. is still more reliant on imported foods than ever before. Molly Ashford is kicking off a series of stories about local food by asking, why our food travels so far to get to our plate?
It's nearing 100 degrees outside of Grand Island, Nebraska, but Billy Ward is decked out in a heavy coat and hat. Ward is the manager of one of five Lineage cold storage facilities in Nebraska. He's walking me through a blast freezer, the coldest part of the 250,000 square foot warehouse.
In this room right here, it's negative 20.
Almost all of the product stored at this particular facility is beef from nearby packing plants. It stays fresh here, and then it's shipped around the world.
For instance, today we have two Ivory Coast going out. We have an Egypt. We have a Korea. We also do Vietnam.
Imported food also sits in warehouses just like this one before heading to U.S. grocery stores. Cold storage facilities and refrigerated trucks make up what's known as the cold chain. That's the network of temperature-controlled storage and transport services that keep perishable foods fresh. Industry groups estimate that up to 70% of all food consumed in the U.S. interacts with the cold chain. Sarah Stickler, the CEO of the Global Cold Chain Alliance, says most people don't think about how their food travels.
When we talk about kind of farm to table, whether that be protein, whether that be harvest, it's coming from a farm and it's going through a process. And most of the time that process includes cold storage.
The cold chain makes agricultural trade possible. And in recent years, the U.S. has become increasingly reliant on imported food, particularly fruits and vegetables. Luis Ribera, who researches North American trade at Texas A&M University, says that's led to a growing agricultural trade deficit. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates it could reach nearly $50 billion in the current fiscal year.
There's a reason why we have a trade deficit, because we consume a lot more products and we have more purchasing power than the neighboring country.
59% of fruits and 35% of fresh vegetables purchased by U.S. consumers are imported from other countries, according to the USDA. Ribera says the deficit is increasing because the products imported to the U.S. are worth more than what we export.
Fruits and vegetables are more expensive than cotton and sorghum and wheat, for example.
That's led some people to ask if the U.S. could become more self-reliant in growing its own produce. Chad Hart, an agronomist with Iowa State University, said the answer is sometimes an obvious no.
We're bringing in things like papayas and mango and, you know, a lot of fruits and vegetables that realistically, we can't grow here.
Hart says the land and climate simply isn't suitable for growing things like bananas or coffee on a large scale. If farmers shifted priorities, they could hypothetically grow more specialty crops like berries or garlic or squash. But Hart says it's often more profitable to stick to one or two crops. And in the Midwest, that's typically corn and soybeans.
These crops are offering the most opportunities to gain markets and to be profitable for farmers.
In the produce section of this grocery store in Omaha, Nebraska, customers pick up products from all over the U.S. and the world. Cherries from Washington, apples from California, and tomatoes from Mexico. Hart says people in the U.S. have grown accustomed to getting the produce they want when they want it.
If U.S. consumers want bananas from Panama, well then, by God, grocery stores will figure out how to get bananas from Panama.
No matter the season or how far it had to travel. I'm Molly Ashford.
That story part of Food Roots, a new series from Harvest Public Media about local food. Harvest is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. Drought in the middle of the country is opening the door for pests and pathogens that can kill trees. That is especially true of a fungus found on oak tree bark, which can turn deadly after extremely dry weather. Jackie Oreda reports on how that's impacting bur oak trees, once known as the king of the Great Plains.
At the base of the observation tower in eastern Nebraska's Mahoney State Park is a graveyard where giant bur oak trees once stood.
They were dying from the tips down, and we noticed in this specific area, it was almost a wedge effect.
Horticulturist Noah Sundberg had to remove 75 trees here last winter. He cares for the park's trees and first started noticing dieback in 2023.
It looked like it was one tree, and then it kind of spread in the direction of the predominant winds.
The widespread mortality was first a mystery to park officials until tests confirmed a disease-causing fungus was running rampant. Hypoxylin canker is a normal part of a tree's bark, but the severity of Nebraska's five-year drought is making trees much more vulnerable.
We're seeing change at an accelerated rate that they can't adapt as readily. So these 150, 200-year-old oak trees just can't handle the conditions of today.
The U.S. Forest Service, in a 2023 report on forest insects and diseases, said climate change is dialing up the effects that disturbances such as fires, flash floods, and drought have on trees across the country. And in turn, pests and pathogens have more opportunity to attack. Hypoxylin canker is common in the South following periods of drought. Clarissa Balbian, a diagnostician and lab manager with Mississippi State University, has dealt with it a lot.
By the time you've seen it, the tree has been under stress for so long that it's probably irreversible at that point. It's just in a decline spiral.
She helped horticulturists in Nebraska identify the disease, but it's also recently affected trees in other Midwestern states, like Kansas and Iowa, after extremely dry periods. Following the 2012 drought, University of Illinois forestry and research specialist Chris Evans saw thousands of oaks die.
We had whole swaths of acres of trees die at times.
Before that, Evan says he hadn't seen much widespread hypoxylin canker cases in southern Illinois. Nearby Missouri suffered similar oak decline following that historic drought.
It was just constant calls about why is my tree dying? What's wrong with my tree? A lot of trees died for us over a bigger area.
At the time, he recommended property owners replant with trees that could survive a future with less water.
Instead of a pin oak, maybe think about a black oak or, a white oak, or move over to other species in general. You know, things like maybe black gums. Some of the hickories are more resistant as well.
Nebraska City, a town designated as a Tree City of the World and the founding home of Arbor Day, is also figuring out how to hold on to the town's tree canopy during drought. For Rob Schreiner, arborist and chairman of Nebraska City's Tree Board, it's hit close to home.
I've lost two in my yard this year, and one of them is it was absolutely gorgeous last year, showed no signs.
Now he's introducing newer species to town that may have better luck through wild swings in weather.
I'm doing a lot of experiments now with the Japanese maples, having really good luck with those. They've come out with some new hybrid elms, which so far have been out for quite a while, and they're really doing well.
While more oaks are set to come down throughout Nebraska's state parks this winter, their stories may not be completely over. Months after forestry crews cut and burned the dead oaks in one park, they noticed resprouts starting from several stumps, sowing hope that the mighty native Nebraska oaks might one day return.
Jackie Oreda with that report. Something we know a lot about here in the Midwest, ticks. Species of ticks are spreading to parts of the country where they've never been found before. Aaron Bolton with Montana Public Radio reports even though scientists know it's happening, local doctors and health officials are often unaware new tick species have arrived, carrying new health risks.
Researcher Grant Hokett is standing in a small meadow full of long grasses and berry bushes. We're in the mountains of northwest Montana. He's leading a small team of tick surveyors.
I can tackle the trail. Devin, you can do anywhere you want along the roadside.
They're looking for ticks smaller than your pinky nail. The equipment isn't high tech.
Some PVC pipe with white flannel cloth.
It looks like a broom, and Hokett sweeps the cloth over the brush on the side of the trail.
There we've got one. So that came off of this bit of sedge grass right here. Simply pick them off with their fingers, and then we've got vials that we pop them in.
Hokett is mostly finding Rocky Mountain wood ticks. It's late morning, and they're ready for a blood meal. They dangle off blades of grass, sticking their legs out, waiting for the next passing mammal or hiker. Later, Hokett will send them to the state epidemiologist in Helena, Devin Cozart, who will test them for pathogens.
The more we know about what's in Montana, the better we can inform our physicians and the better care you can receive.
This year, Hokett and his team found deer ticks in Montana for the first time. Deer ticks are the ones that are infamous because they carry Lyme disease. But if Montana doctors don't know they're here, they won't look for Lyme disease in their patients. Cozart, the state epidemiologist, tests new tick species and ones that have been here a long time. A tiny percentage of a tick population could be carrying a particular disease, or almost all of them could be. Knowing that helps predict how many people might get sick after a bite.
If we're seeing any change in how many ticks are carrying pathogens and where those pathogens are being carried by the ticks.
But this kind of surveillance isn't happening in every state or county. A national survey of local health departments found only 25% of them track tick populations. That's not enough, according to Chelsea Gridley-Smith, an environmental scientist who did the survey for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Many health departments use passive surveillance. They rely on patients or their doctors or even veterinarians to mail dead ticks to public health labs for identification and testing.
Does provide a little bit of information about like what ticks are actually interacting with people and animals, but it doesn't really get into the weeds of how common are ticks, are those ticks in that area, and how often do those ticks carry pathogens.
Montana gets about $60,000 a year from the federal government for this work, but most of that is spent on tracking mosquitoes. Hokett says he doesn't have enough money to survey everywhere he would like to in a state as large as Montana. In the Sunny Meadow in western Montana, the team is tallying their count.
But I got three.
Oh, nice.
Oh, good.
Okay. You got two.
Seven ticks.
For now, Hokett has only found deer ticks in eastern Montana, an eight-hour drive from here. And it's unclear if they're hitchhikers or have begun breeding and establishing a local population. Deer ticks are also called black-legged ticks.
We just simply don't have enough data to get a very good predictive model for black-legged ticks in Montana.
To know more, he'd need more money for surveys. But he's pretty sure it's inevitable that they're coming to western Montana. And he thinks a meadow just like this one will be prime habitat. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Condon, Montana.
Specialty bookstores dedicated to cookbooks are seeing growing success across the country. Ella Caniz visited a tiny indie bookstore in St. Louis to get a taste of what it has to offer.
We do have to-go containers at the end of the night, so...
A couple dozen people gathered at a cooking studio in Midtown for a hot dish meeting. It's part book club, part dinner party, and it's hosted by Anchovy Book Co. Everyone brought a dish to share made from the same cookbook. There's Chicago-style Italian beef, smoked trout, and lots of dessert enjoyed by a diverse group of people.
Like younger, early 20s, all the way up to like seniors who come.
That's Stephanie McKenney, the co-owner of Anchovy.
And so it's really, really fun to bring everyone together for that kind of event. And the food is always so good. It's so good.
The indie store has been hosting monthly book club meetings, attracting bookworms, avid home cooks, and novices, all for a night of good bites. Bookstores that exclusively sell cookbooks aren't very common. There are around 15 in the country, but interest in them is growing. McKenney has been cooking up the idea of creating a specialty cookbook store for almost a decade. Last November, she and her best friend Sarah Johnson opened their doors on Cherokee Street for business.
I would say I'm very surprised at how into cookbooks St. Louis is.
They turned a profit in their first quarter, but McKenney says the goal of the store is more than retail.
I would say the vision for the store is to build community and to build community around cooking and spending time together.
On a hot Sunday afternoon this month, a few customers flipped through a curated selection of cookbooks. At just 6 feet wide, the store is compact, like its namesake, Tin of Fish. But it's thoughtfully packed with color and cookbooks, and it's got a welcoming feel, like walking into a friend's kitchen.
It's brown sugar banana bread. Looks really good.
Jayla Sims picks out a book that she hopes will motivate her to cook at home more and reduce her online food orders.
Excited to see. I got a back in the day bakery cookbook. I love baking. And there's also some savory dishes in here too, so I figured, you know, it's a good mix. For me, I've been trying to get more physical media things, and I don't know, something about a cookbook, it feels so homey and cozy.
Cookbooks are often a popular category, but sales have grown by 8% since 2010, with numbers boosted further by the pandemic. That's because cookbooks meet people's needs for comfort in a way most other genres don't, says Grace Hagen, the executive director of the Midwest Independent Booksellers Association.
People are seeking ways to interact with others and have something to communicate around, to commune around, to find joy around.
In addition to cookbooks, Anchovy sells a few kitchen items such as aprons and tinned fish. That's what drew Andrew O'Sullivan and Ben Doan into the store. The couple are part of a tinned fish club in their hometown of Memphis.
So just seeing like anchovy in the name, this sounded so cute and so just fun. And I looked at pictures of it and it looked just, it's all my cookbooks. And it's like that's such an interesting like topic for a bookstore to be focused on cookbooks.
They picked up a tin of fish to share with their club members and also brought home a Japanese cookbook.
All right, it'll be $61.97. Go ahead. But yeah, because we, like when we were in Japan, we had miso soup and like lots of dashis in the morning. And so we just want to kind of reincorporate that.
Doan says she often turns to cooking apps and blogs for meal ideas, but has noticed that she gets caught up on ratings and what other people think of a recipe.
And with a cookbook, it kind of eliminates that, so you just have to take a chance, and it's kind of fun.
For the store's owners, cookbooks are about much more than food. They're about connection, the kind that happens around a dinner table or while passing a tried and tested recipe to a loved one.
We'll learn more about roller derby. That's on the way on Statewide. Thank you. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Roller derby is resilient, just like the skaters who keep the sport alive. Roller derby was arguably at its peak in popularity decades ago, but a revival in the early 2000s brought a new generation of skaters into the sport. That includes the women and men of the Prairieland Punishers, a team that includes Bloomington Normal skaters. Reporter Vashti Reed reports the Punishers are emerging from the pandemic with another way to evolve the sport.
Normally, the only sounds you hear at Maroa City Hall are city council meetings or people stopping by to get a building permit. But tonight, a large hall on the backside of City Hall is home to a Prairieland Punishers roller derby team practice. They're practicing for their next bout, a doubleheader Saturday, September 6th at the Interstate Center. And it's not just any bout. The 7 o'clock showdown is the first ever bout open to both women and men that's sanctioned by the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, also known as WFDA. Punisher skater Sierra Henry from Bloomington says that the open division bout is a big deal.
Hopefully there's going to be more opportunities for roller derby in Central Illinois and beyond. I know that there were a lot of leagues that folded during COVID, and so being able to bring everyone together through this bout is really incredible.
The Prairieland Punishers formed in Decatur about 14 years ago. It's since grown into a regional team with skaters from Bloomington, Peoria, Champaign, Springfield, and Decatur. The Punishers invited WGLT to a recent practice in Maroa, about 30 miles south of Bloomington. The first thing we wanted to know was, how do you win a roller derby bout? It starts with the two types of skaters, jammers and blockers. We'll let a skater known as Goldie Rocks from Pekin explain the rest.
Well, you win by getting the most points, and you get points because by the jammer passing blockers. So every blocker that a jammer passes, they get a point for. I'm a blocker, and the jammer wears a star. This is why my shirt says blockers aim for the stars, because I'm going for that jammer, that star, trying to prevent that person from passing me.
If it sounds a little bit chaotic, that's because it is. Melissa Sylvester, aka Smash Tag, one of the team captains, says roller derby is unique.
It's the only sport that I know of that you play offense and defense at the same time.
What makes a good skater? Practice helps, but it's also an attitude, a skill set, and a will to win.
What makes a great skater is the wanting to be a great skater, putting in the effort, putting in the time on skates. That's what makes somebody a great skater.
The Punishers like winning, but it's clear it's about more than winning. On this close-knit team, friendships form fast. Being part of a team like this also opens some skaters' eyes to new experiences, new surroundings, and new people.
I think it's the people, it's the camaraderie, the friendships. I met my best friend through roller derby, so I met my husband through roller derby.
Here's Punisher skater David France, who goes by the derby name Havoc. He'll be one of the men skating in the open gender division.
For me, I do derby for the practices. That's where you come, you see your friends, you spend time with friends, you work together to do certain things, to accomplish things. You're trying to make them better, they're trying to make you better. And it ends up a relationship where you start supporting each other on the track, and then you have a family that you has your back and supports you off the track also.
Relationships are not all roller derby offers to these skaters. They also get some bruises and sometimes full-blown injuries.
My first year, in my very first game, I broke my ankle and tore all the ligaments on the right side of my foot. I have had a couple of concussions, and I have had a broken nose and broken orbital socket, which is why I wear a visor now.
And given their high-impact, high-injury hobby, most of the skaters we interviewed have relatively normal day jobs.
I am the Senior Media Relations Specialist with Illinois Farm Bureau.
I'm an IT manager for automotive manufacturer.
I am what you would call a product analyst.
I work for the Postal Service.
You can catch the Prairieland Punishers in action during Saturday's doubleheader. They'll start at 5 with a bout against Demolition City Roller Derby from Evansville, Indiana. Then at 7, it's the sanctioned open gender bout with the Peoria Prowlers. Fans are welcomed at both. And if you catch the roller derby bug and want to try it yourself, the Punishers are hosting an open gendered boot camp on September 19th. All skate levels are welcomed and no prior experience is needed. Here's some closing advice from Havoc.
Show up. One moment can change your life. You can have friends for the rest of your life, but if you don't show up and make yourself present, nothing will ever happen.
I'm Vashti Reed.
A trained weather spotter has built an online following of weather watchers in central Illinois. Eric Stock explains.
Tom Bessler always had his eye on the weather. After he retired following a long career in grounds maintenance, including 20 years at Illinois Central College, Bessler says he was bored silly. So he decided to take his passion for watching the weather into a service to help others. Bessler, who lives in Bartonville, south of Peoria, created the Facebook group Current Central Illinois Weather. It's grown to more than 8,000 members in just over a year. Bessler provides frequent updates about weather events, particularly during severe weather, by sharing information from trusted sources, including the National Weather Service. Bessler says he's not a meteorologist, but he takes annual weather spotter training courses, and he encourages other weather curious people to do the same.
It gave me the knowledge to being a spotter for the National Weather Service in Lincoln. It gave me the knowledge to know what I was looking at instead of just working on the golf course or working for ICC and saying, well, okay, it's raining. Now, taking the spotter class, I was able to see the storms building. I've got a weather app on my, or a radar app on my phone, so I can see the storms building in other counties and moving and stuff. And it just kind of, it helped me get more educated with the science part of it.
Now, how did the Current Central Illinois Weather Facebook page come to be?
I have my own personal Facebook page, and I would post, I live in Bartonville, Illinois, and I would post weather alerts and stuff on that. And a couple of people came to my wife and said, well, why don't Tom start his own Facebook page, a group page? And I got with another person that helped me get it all set up and stuff. And it just kind of fell from there. And it started out about a year and a half ago. And it really took off. I've told people I cover as much as severe weather as I can for the whole state to try to give people as much information about it and stuff.
Are people really going to social media in times of severe weather?
I see that they are, because most people are on social media a lot. And I have found that out just with mine, that they are on there. It's almost like they're on there more. They're on their phone more than they are sitting in front of the TV, because everybody's on the go all the time.
Do you see that there is a need for this?
Yes, actually I do. Since I took the initial spotter training class with my son back in 2020, I've taken the spotter training class from the National Weather Service in Quad Cities, in Chicago, Indianapolis, and St. Louis. And initially, the National Weather Service in Quad Cities also has a winter spotter training class. And so I've taken all of that training, and I've tried to get people that are in the group to take the class, because it's 2 hours, and you can do it either in person or online, and it's free. And it even if you don't want to go out and be a spotter, you can still take the class and understand how weather develops, how the storms look, the different stages of the tornado development and activity. And then I've even trying to get people to get weather radios and stuff.
That was weather spotter Tom Bessler from the Current Central Illinois Weather Facebook group. Bessler says despite all the job cuts at the National Weather Service, it's still the leading authority for tracking severe weather.
That's Eric Stock with that report. Thank you. The former attorney for President Trump, now leading the department's Civil Rights Division, wants to undo a landmark Illinois gun law. A challenge to the state's assault weapons ban enacted by Governor Pritzker is before a federal appeals court. The court's agreeing to let Justice Department official Harmeet Dhillon argue against the law. Hannah Hill is with the Pro-Gun National Foundation for Gun Rights and says Dhillon's involvement signals a shift in thinking.
Harmeet has done a new thing by unequivocally stating multiple times the Second Amendment rights are civil rights. And everything that she's doing at the Justice Department is underscoring the fact that she means that.
Illinois Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin slammed Dhillon ahead of her spring confirmation. He said she is, quote, more likely to attack civil rights than defend them. Student interest in career and technical education programs like welding and automotive is surging across the U.S. And as Peter Medlin reports, Waubonsie Community College just opened its own massive new technical education center to meet the demand.
Ryan Dutton spent the past week exploring the auto shop. It's part of the college's new 100,000 square foot facility, which also includes the automotive collision and refinishing and the welding programs. Dutton is an automotive student.
Definitely more high end. The old shop was probably what I assume any normal shop would look like. Everything's all dirty and used.
The old shop was built in the 70s. It was crowded, three service bays, no air conditioning. The new shop has over 20 bays, and unlike a lot of shops students might work in after graduation, it has air conditioning. Guy Tiberio is an associate professor of automotive technology, and he says they designed this new space to be not just bigger, but equipped in line with or a bit ahead of industry trends. It's why the space has an ADAS, or Advanced Driver Assistance System, that calibrates cameras and sensors for modern features like self-driving and lane departure warning.
We never had the space for the equipment to do those calibrations, and it's still something very new to the industry. So a lot of shops don't even have that at this point. There's a few select shops that do. So when we built this building, we designed a purpose-built space for those.
The new larger space also means they could hire a new instructor and offer more classes to help students graduate sooner.
There's no more waiting around for that one or two classes that you need. You know, before you might wait 2 years for one class to come around, and that would obviously slow down student progress.
The automotive program is popular. They've been at capacity for years and have to turn students away. It's also an in-demand career. Tiberio says the auto industry is plagued by workforce shortages. It's both because there are more cars on the road than ever and also more people leaving the industry or retiring than coming in. Nikisha Stepney is Waubonsie's assistant provost of workforce development. She says auto collision courses also filled up in record time, and she was thrilled to see their welding classes filling fast, even after doubling the capacity. And like with automotive, interest is aligning with need. The program's added over 100 new students compared to last fall.
That let me know, and it validated that we were headed in the right direction with choosing this to be one of the signature programs in this building.
And the new center is a major investment. The construction costs $60 million. So Stephanie says that's why they host advisory meetings with local businesses.
I think it's incumbent upon us as the community college to look at what is needed in our district, in the region, and then create programming that aligns with that.
Stephanie says that these career and technical education programs are a major growth area for community colleges as schools fight for enrollment. And it's not just Waubonsie pouring money into career and tech programs. Other Illinois community colleges like Spoon River, John A. Logan, Rock Valley, and Elgin Community College are all currently building new CTE centers. But Stephanie says it's more of a collaboration than a competition.
ECC came and visited our facility to tour. When we were planning this building, we went to other community colleges to tour.
High school skilled trades programs are also growing, which is crucial since many of those pathways lead to community colleges. Nearly 140,000 Illinois high schoolers are considered CTE concentrators, meaning they've completed multiple career and tech courses. That's more than a 30% increase from 2 years ago. So when a high school in Waubonsie's district built a new center a few years ago, Stephanie says they were happy to be at the table. Next year, students in short-term programs will qualify for federal Pell Grants for the first time, which Stephanie says could be another boon to technical education. And she says the new center still leaves them with room to grow as both the need and interest in CTE increases. I'm Peter Medlin.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And don't forget to join us next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.